last financial crisis left a whole generation of Americans wary of banking institutions and taking on debt. It has taken most of the last decade for people to process how the 2008 financial crisis came to be and why, as entire families lost their middle-class dreams of home ownership and upward mobility, those on Wall Street were saved by the federal government. A new book takes this line of questioning further and asks, is any bank really too big to fail? Specifically, how did one of the biggest beneficiaries of the 2008 bailout, Citi, become too big to fail? This is a book as much about the history of banking as it is about Citi, and it offers keen insights into how Citi has changed over the last 200 years from being an institution that the federal government could turn to in times of need to a behemoth financial house that has repeatedly required government aid. The book is titled Borrowed Time, Two Centuries of Booms, Busts, and Bailouts at Citi, and it was written by James Freeman and Vern McKinley. I'm very pleased that James Freeman is joining us today. Welcome, James.
Thanks. Great to be here. Appreciate the kind words.
Absolutely. I want to go back to the beginning, if we could, to understand how Citi got where it is. We have to go to the turn of the 19th century and the founding of the Citi Bank of New York. Is the history of U.S. banking and that of Citi almost one and the same? Is it all intertwined?
Well, there's certain similarities. Citi began essentially as a creation of politics. Many of the shareholders who had owned the first bank of the United States, when that closed, they then struck a political deal to create a new New York State chartered bank, and that was Citibank. It didn't go well in the early years, but eventually that gave way to what is sort of the story of 19th century banking versus the current variety, which is that bankers were independent, and those that succeeded did so through care and hard work, and some failed. And it's a very different model than our basically the last century or so, where we see government standing behind big institutions, and in Citibank's case, a series of crises over the last 100 years.
So how did it start? How was the initial capital raised in order to start the bank?
It was a bunch of, I guess you would call prominent citizens of the time, many of them very connected politically. As I said, you had to get rival factions together in the New York State Legislature. But it was capitalized with investments from these founding directors, but not very highly capitalized. As I say, they were political operators. They also had the nasty habit of wanting to lend to themselves and perhaps their friends, and so it really struggled in its early years. It was had several crises until the Panic of 1837, and as there was no custom or expectation or perhaps a strength for the federal government or state government to bail them out, the bank would have failed if not for a private rescue by John Jacob Astor, who was at that time the richest man in the country.
That was 1837, but the bank started, yes. What year did the bank start, remind us?
Oh, right, sorry, 1812.
Yeah, 1812. And one of the first things that the bank financed was indeed the War of 1812, right?
That's right, and this is how the roughly the first century of the bank, it's another way it contrasts so much with our current system, where we see this recent period, 2008, where you have the government bailing out financial institutions, and in Citi's case, three different bailouts. But back at the beginning, it was often the government that needed help from bankers. So to finance the War of 1812, it was a tremendous struggle. The Congress would authorize the Treasury Secretary to borrow certain amounts, but often he wouldn't find enough investors to lend the government the money. This is kind of funny today as we think about the huge U.S. Treasury debt market. It's the most liquid in the world, and obviously, thank goodness, lots of people who want to own Treasury debt. Back then, it was a tough process where the Treasury Secretary would call on generally very wealthy men in Philadelphia or New York and try to borrow the money. But Citi was not only helpful in the financing at that point, but it also there was a Citi director who outfitted a privateer, a ship to go battle the British on the high seas. Unfortunately, after it launched, it was never heard from again.
The ship was never heard from again.
That's right. But you can't say that Citi and its directors at that point weren't doing everything they could to help our young country and to fund the government.
If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Katz, and you're listening to Midday on WNYC. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal writer James Freeman about his new book, Borrowed Time, Two Centuries of Booms, Busts, and Bailouts at Citi. His co-author is Vern McKinley. James, in terms of financing the War of 1812, was that an example of how the way things used to function, how the way the bank used to function, that the institution bolstered the government rather than the other way around?
Yeah, and we see it over and over again in the 19th century. The Citi was also crucial in funding the Union Army, especially in the early stages of the Civil War. The man who led Citi at that point, Moses Taylor, probably one of the great business people that we've never heard of, or most people haven't heard of him, but was running a rock-solid financial institution, and like a lot of New York bankers and merchants of the time, was not, I guess you would say, was ambivalent or worse about slavery, because they did a lot of business with the South and they wanted that commerce to continue. But once war began, he became a rock solid defender of Lincoln and really led the early financing of the Union cause.
Why did he see some financial benefit to getting involved in the war in that way?
He may have. I think most of all, he had a conviction that the Union had to be held together, and I think it was more than any particular thoughts about the great question of the time. It was really his sense that the country had to hold together, and I think he thought that was also what was best for the economy, and so he was a stalwart defender from that point on.
Why else was he such an impactful leader of the bank at the time? This
well,
is Moses Taylor,
again,
by the way. Yeah,
yeah. It's so much a contrast to the 20th century, early 21st, where we have in Citi and some of the other large institutions, they have a government safety net. They tend to operate with very low levels of capital, in other words, buffers to absorb losses in a crisis, compared to when you look at what we might call independent banking in the last century. And so Moses Taylor is a very careful, responsible man. You can see in the his papers, which are still at the New York Public Library, he carefully keeps the books himself, and he. As he's starting out, he's so careful in maintaining reserves of capital and of cash, of liquidity in a crisis, that as a merchant, he weathers, it seems, just about every disaster that can be thrown at him. There was a great fire in Wall Street in the 1830s, and he was able to open for business the next day at his home.
Wow.
He similarly... He would go through various, and there were a lot of financial panics especially in the latter half of the 19th century, and so different from 2008, where these financial giants are often buckling and needing assistance during a panic or a crisis. The Citi was so strong, and Moses Taylor was so well respected that the bank would often gather deposits. In other words, it was the opposite of a run on the bank. When people were nervous, they would want to give their money to Citi and to Moses Taylor.
How about that? You mentioned that you referenced documents at the New York Public Library from Moses Taylor. Did you actually go there and read these original documents from the 1800s?
Yeah, I did, and it's interesting to see in his very neat cursive handwriting, the various accounts and debtors and creditors and investments made by the firm. And he was so highly respected, and you talk about sort of a pillar of the business community. He was very involved in the Cuban sugar trade, which at that time was an enormous part of the economy in terms of trade, and he was essentially the banker often to the great sugar growers in Cuba, and he had other international clients as well, and they trusted him so much that they would not only hire him to be their agent in the United States for business purposes, but often they would send him their children. They would say, Moses Taylor, please educate them in the U.S. and look after them in loco parentis. And so you go through his papers and you see various notes about tuition payments he was making or other necessities of life that he was taking care of on behalf of these children of his clients. And he would even be consulted when they would get a little older and look for a spouse, and the clients would get Moses Taylor's opinion on the prospective match. So really kind of a remarkable figure. I don't think most people have heard of him because he did not make sort of the huge charitable donations and put his name on buildings and so forth. But I think taxpayers who watched the 2008 crisis probably wish we had a few Moses Taylors or a few more on Wall Street.
Absolutely. After Moses Taylor came James Stillman. How did he compare and contrast to the leadership of Moses Taylor?
Well, Stillman, there was a little gap there where Percy Pine, who was not in very good health, ran the bank. And then you get to Stillman, and he really takes what is a solid, responsible institution and makes it the biggest bank in the country. And that is in large part by becoming, it was known as the oil bank because Standard Oil was the big client there. And what was interesting about that was that John D. Rockefeller never actually liked Stillman, but Stillman was good friends with the brother, William Rockefeller. And similar to Moses Taylor, it is a rock-solid institution, high capital. People want to go to it in a crisis. And this is where, in the 1890s, twice he comes to the government's rescue when it's in trouble. It can't, it doesn't have enough gold. The Treasury calls J.P. Morgan in New York and says, we need gold, and he's unable to find all of it, and he goes to Stillman, and Stillman is able to arrange the gold to make sure the federal government has enough reserve, and then later helps when the government has what appears to be a disastrous investment in the railroad industry, and he takes over and ends up turning a profit actually for the taxpayer. But I don't think Stillman would have been a fun guy to work for. His biographers talk about how no one ever remembers him offering a word of praise. He was known as the man in the iron mask, and so he didn't say much except to criticize. And they talk about how he would examine in great detail every potential creditor and every asset on their balance sheet. And again, it was, I think, maybe sort of a Steve Jobs kind of character, really a ruthless, difficult boss to deal with, but when you look at the product, quite amazing. And again, it was so striking thinking about 2008, how much we could have used someone like James Stillman or Moses Taylor.
I'm Matt Katz, and I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal writer James Freeman about his new book, Borrowed Time, Two Centuries of Booms, Busts, and Bailouts at Citi, co-authored with Vern McKinley. I'm Matt Katz. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm speaking with James Freeman about his new book on the history of Citibank. And I would love, James, to turn to the 20th century. And this is where things start to change for Citi. So can we start with the panic of 1907 and what correspondent banking is all about?
Yes, so correspondent banking is basically when a bank is a bank serving as a bank for other banks. So it's city in New York would want to have correspondent banking relationships with various smaller banks out at other parts of the country, and often the smaller banks elsewhere in the country would send send their reserves, their deposits to be kept by Citi in New York.
And
the, the panic of 1907, this is just about where we're seeing the turn. We were talking about how Citi is this, has become the biggest bank in the country, and it's a rock-solid institution and becomes an island of stability during crises. And that was the role it played once again in 1907, although perhaps for the last time. This is began a panic. It was an economic downturn, but also a problem of a particular type of banks called trust banks that were running into trouble. And in order to attempt to rescue them, to lend to them if they had good collateral, was a private sector bailout, you might say, organized by J.P. Morgan, but relying heavily on Citi. I guess what it worked, and it's funny because it was not as panics and economic downturns of the time go. It was not that severe, but for whatever reason, it did inspire people to want another way of handling bank crises, and really led to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. 1907 is also kind of an interesting transition because it's seen as a private sector bailout, which then led to the creation of the Federal Reserve to have a government role. But there was actually, 1907 was sort of the beginning of the government getting involved in rescuing banks, because they did the federal government did make a number of deposits to institutions with the idea that they would lend to other institutions in trouble. So this is kind of the beginning of where we turn from what you might say is the era of freedom to succeed or fail in banking to the Federal Reserve era, where the government takes a role in backstopping these firms.
And who created the Federal Reserve? How did that then come to be? It was directly connected to what was happening with Citi in 1907,
yeah.
But who created it?
Yeah, people have developed a lot of conspiracy theories.
There's a lot of theories. You can't Google this question. You won't get the right answer.
Yeah. And you can understand why, because it sort of was a conspiracy. And that's how Frank Vanderlip, who would go on to run Citibank, had been or was at Citibank at that time, and was the new president there. And had been at the Treasury Department. That's how he essentially acknowledges in his autobiography, which is fascinating, by the way. He did not run Citi very well, but he wrote a heck of a book. he talks about how they basically, a bunch of the leaders of huge New York financial institutions got together to write a plan for Senator Nelson Aldrich to propose. And he's very clear in the autobiography that they realized that this could never sell. They would never get away with it politically if it was correctly viewed as the product of a collaboration among New York financiers. And so they have this kind of bizarre effort of gathering in Jekyll Island, Georgia, which at that time, and I'm not sure if it still is, but was a high-end resort, and they went to such lengths. They were using fake names as they began their journey south. They went to a spot in New Jersey. They thought that would attract less attention, I believe, and got on a train car that was secretly attached to the back of another train, and did not disclose to anyone where they were going. And then ultimately drew the plan for what we know as the Federal Reserve.
What were they worried about? Why was it done in such secrecy?
Well, I think they probably thought that public would view it skeptically if it was seen as a plan written by the big banks, and I think one of the reasons they may have been concerned was that it was a plan that was very good for big banks, because what it did was it continued a series of policies that had really been the source of some instability that encouraged this movement we were talking about of banks in other parts of the country sending their reserves, their deposits to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So what the plan did is it maintained that system, ensured that banks like Citi would have a very good correspondent business taking the deposits of banks from other parts of the country, but also created, to deal with the instability, a new federal system to lend in times of crisis. It also, because of its structure, resulted in many of the leaders of the New York banking community then being having important roles on within the Fed and on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York specifically.
And impact the business it did. You write that by 1920, Citi's borrowings from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had skyrocketed to $95 million, more than triple the $28 million reported during the 1919 examination, and that the bank's capital was just $88 million on the date of the examination. How could Citi's role have shifted so quickly in less than a decade? What happened that led to that?
It's kind of amazing. I think, as you said, how quickly the shift is. I think many economists would say this is moral hazard in one lesson, where you're adding a safety net which is bound to encourage more dangerous behavior. You go from the 1890s, when Stillman has built Citi into the biggest bank in the country. It's so solid. It's rescuing the government when it gets into trouble. It's gaining deposits in each crisis. 1907, Citi again fulfilling the role of this rock of stability, and then Federal Reserve gets created in 1913, and almost immediately the bank, Citi, is making huge mistakes investing overseas, basically expanding too quickly, you might say recklessly. And what's happened here is that James Stillman, this incredibly difficult man to work for, probably not much fun to live with either, after he split up with Mrs. Stillman, he instructed people in his household never to speak her name again.
Wow.
But one thing he did was he was a fanatic about maintaining the strength of the institution.
Mm-hmm.
But he gives way to a former Treasury official, you might say a political operator, a former journalist, actually, Frank Vanderlip, very connected with Washington, very intimately involved, as we discussed, creating the Federal Reserve. Not the same rigorous banker that Stillman was, and pretty soon, with this new system, he's making all kinds of investments overseas that Citi would end up regretting. Some of it, you might say, bad luck, bad timing. Citi opens a branch in Russia in 1917.
And it does not fare very well?
Well, believe it or not, it actually did great business for the few months before it was seized by the communists.
And, that's bad timing to open a bank in Russia, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So making sure that some New York financiers were made whole was not high on the agenda of Comrade Lenin once the revolution kicked in. So, but that was just one of the overseas mistakes. And so it's just in this incredibly, it actually happened, but in this very rapid period of time, they go from private strong bank to government-backed bank to bank in deep trouble. And we know about this heavy borrowing from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in that 1919, 1920, 1921 period because of exam reports that my co-author Vern McKinley uncovered. But we wanted to know more, and so we wanted to get all of the lending records from the New York Fed, and as far as I can tell, they don't exist. And this is an issue we talk about in the book. The New York Fed says they don't have any records. I believe they have been destroyed, because what happens is, and this is true in the modern era as well, records are generally kept quiet, or I should say, prevented from being disclosed to the public. You file Freedom of Information Act requests, and they are often denied. Yep. We had some denied on the grounds that this is sensitive information that can't be shared. Then, after a certain period of years, they're simply destroyed on a regular schedule. And I'm hoping that one thing maybe that might come out of this book is that policymakers, whatever their point of view, whatever policies they want, will say, let's not have the Fed keep destroying documents that prevent people from learning about its history.
Yeah, and understanding the mistakes of the past. In the 20s, the Citibank also changed the kind of banking it was doing, expanding from not just commercial banking, also investing, as you were talking about. Were they also creating a new kind of American customer as well at the same time, in the same way?
Yeah, and you know, this would be a story later in the bank's history as well. You now have a bank that's more unstable, has more periods of crises, but often also periods of innovation. And so you have, along with the risks, you do have in many ways an innovative bank, and I think it. There's a lot of good that came out of that in terms of bringing financial services to the mass market. So many things we sort of take for granted today in terms of the customer's ability to get credit, credit cards, consumer lending, and also investing in stocks and bonds. People are whatever their income level are able to save and invest, and that wasn't necessarily the case then. But that is one thing I think you have to give Citi credit for during that period is bringing to the average person options for their financial lives that before that point were really reserved only for the very rich.
Right, and helped to increase the wealth of the everyman. Mm-hmm. Then let's move though to the flip side of that, the Great Depression. How much money did the government agree to give Citi in 1933?
So in terms of a direct investment, the government ends up investing $50 million in Citi and a few other banks. These are no one got a larger bailout. Although we put a little question mark on that, because the bank had presented it as a we saw a little of this in 2008, some of the banks saying they actually didn't need the money, but they accepted it as a supporting a general government policy of adding capital to banks and allowing them to do more lending. There can be an argument about it, but there is no doubt the government put in $50 million into Citi. There was no bigger amount that went to any bank. Wow. And this is very much a change from the earlier Citi history that we talked about.
Sure. We only have a few minutes left, so we have to pivot to 2008. How much did Citi lose, and then how much did regulators end up offering Citi in their bailouts?
Yeah, over a period, several quarters, 2007, 2008, 2009, the bank recorded tens of billions of dollars in losses, and the government support, which was the largest to any bank, was a series of bailouts that amounted to $45 billion in direct investment.
$45 billion with a B, right? Yeah.
Yes, but that really almost doesn't scratch the surface, because one thing in the course of doing this book, we got an FDIC document, and they had tallied up the various support. So the $45 billion is the direct investment. Then there were all kinds of guarantees that the various parts of the federal government offered to Citi in terms of on its assets, on its debt. And that tally, according to the FDIC, was more like $500 billion in terms of...
Wow.
Now, some of that is assets that the government is insuring. It's not that taxpayers put in $500 billion, but it gives you a scale, like half a trillion dollars of support of one kind or another, or guarantees on assets amounting to that. So it really a phenomenal amount of money. And the 2008 story, it is... As we look at the bank going up to that crisis, it is pretty much the opposite of the Stillman-Moses Taylor era as we were talking about. It has very little capital. It's running big risks. And one thing I think people should understand, because there's often a debate about particular types of financial companies. So they'll say, well, Wall Street trading is very dangerous, but old school Main Street lending is fine. And what we see in the Citi example is problems across the board, from the most complex financial instruments to the most simple loans. And I would say the common problem was overinvestment in the U.S. housing market, but also a problem when a bank that has been expecting and relying on that federal support for so long ends up being run with such high risks and so little capital in the event of a crisis.
James, thank you so much. This is
Thanks, Matt.
A wide and breathtaking history of Citibank. I appreciate you joining me.